This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. The wandering uterus, the belief that a displaced womb was the cause of medical mysteries that seemed to only affect women, that was the ancient European medical take on mass hysteria. In Malaysia, the locals explained such outbreaks as spirits having possessed girls and young women. Mass hysteria can cause significant disruption to daily activities. Last month, SMK Pengkalan Cepadua was temporarily shut down amid a case of mass hysteria. But why does it seem to affect mainly females? And what does modern medicine know about this curious phenomenon? Consultant psychiatrist Dr. Philip George unravels the mystery with me. Welcome to the show, Dr. Philip.
Oh, thanks, Julian. Nice to be here.
What is mass hysteria in the medical and cultural sense?
Well, it's now classified in our psychiatric classification as dissociative or somatoform disorder, which really means that somebody's trying to exhibit or express their emotional trouble in bodily symptoms or in, you know, stages of phases of dissociation where they start to think that they're somebody else, or they see things, or they vision things, or they become really behaviorally disturbed. There are some other terms that are used. Mass psychogenic illness is another phrase that's often used to describe mass hysteria. But basically what it's trying to say is that these are people who can't process anxiety, emotional crisis in appropriate way. And so they show it in physical and other symptoms or behavioral symptoms.
All that is well and good, but why do they do it together, I think, is the question. Because you, of course, I mean, what you're describing, sounds like mental illness, you know, of a certain type. But why does it seem to spread, or why does it seem to manifest at the same time?
You know, if you just take a single person with hysteria, and that can be anybody. I mean, I think everyone's gone through this episode where they were so frustrated, so angry, or so disappointed.
Or so scared.
Yeah, so scared. And they couldn't express it. And they showed it in physical symptoms, like hitting the head on the wall, or hitting, you know, using their hands to hit the head, or, you know, putting their hands up and yelling, or, you know, just moving around in circles. And, you know, I think we all look back, we've dealt with stress when we weren't really capable of it in that sort of way. Now, when people have similar sort of settings, that means they share the same sort of stress or the same settings, then it starts to be able to spread. What we often identify is that it usually can start with somebody who's more vulnerable, so somebody who may have an underlying illness, and so they can then perhaps, because of the stress, exhibit this hysteria. And then it goes on to maybe others who may have some vulnerability as well. And then gradually it spreads throughout the whole group because they share something in common.
What is, so that something could be anything? Is it usually a circumstance, or is it a, or is it some sort of trait?
It's usually a demography. So it could be, you know, all girls. It could be people staying in a hostel, people of the same religion, people of the same age group, people who, are all put together in a certain place. So, yeah, so they share these things in common. The other thing that often we can identify is if we look closely enough, there's been something that's been introduced to them that's caused the whole group some amount of stress.
So would you consider then, what would you consider a high-risk mass hysteria setting? You know, so because the examples tend to be girls, by and large, not necessarily even women, but girls.
Yeah.
And as you say, hostels and schools, that seems to be the way of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Hippocrates actually identified hysteria way back in the BCs. And so that's how that term, you know, roaming womb came about, because he sort of identified it more in women. But we know that it also happens in men. It's happened in army camps, in, you know, in youth clubs as well. It happens more in women still. But I think some of the factors there include the inability to be able to be assertive and to change things in the way that they would like, and also not having the opportunity to express emotions and feelings in an appropriate way.
Would you say that, is there a way then to kind of take note of when, because the situations that you described are multiple and they're common, you know, boarding schools are common, you have people living in bunkers, you have people who might be feeling besieged. I mean, it's not uncommon at all to imagine all the girls, you know, in boarding school somewhere listening, waiting for exams. It's not at all something that's rare. At what point, or is there a way then to say, this is a high-risk situation and you might be seeing people perhaps getting a little bit more anxious or exhibiting certain signs? You know, are there things to look out for in that way?
Yeah. I mean, I think the important thing in our context is it seems to be happening in the same area. Kelantan is often one of the states that gets affected very often with mass hysteria. It's been reported in the journals that in 1971, they had 15 cases of mass hysteria. And that was largely in Kelantan, with only two schools in an urban area, but most of the other schools, 15 of them, actually in rural areas. And they were largely Malay population and all girls as well. So we can identify specific demographics that are, you know, unique to maybe a certain population. There are other places in the world that has had history. What I call an example is the Salem witch hunt. So, you know, that was way back in the 1600s, but there were young girls who were being affected with hysteria and it seemed to spread and they felt that it was caused by people in the community who they branded as witches. And in fact, 16 women were sort of executed because they were thought to be witches. And in the end, they realized that perhaps this was not exactly what it should have been. And it was part of the hysterical episode that these girls experienced. So it's unique to each different country and locality. And so it's hard to predict overall throughout the world, but it'll be easier to predict in our community. So, for example, here in Malaysia, it is usually in hostels where there may be strict rules and regulations. There may be less interaction with people from outside of those schools. There may be, you know, more discipline and a lack of opportunity for the students.
Expression.
Yeah, for the students to be involved in, you know, deciding how the school is run and, you know, what are their needs and their ways of dealing with things.
15 in how long was it? Over the course of how many?
Over the course of a year.
Right. So that makes it sound, you know, not uncommon. But overall, how common are mass hysteria episodes?
Well, in Malaysia, it comes and goes. So there are periods and there are sort of epidemics that we can identify. I think the recent episode was. I mean, it could have been related to the flood disaster in the past, and that was, you know, largely in the northern state of Kelantan as well, and the difficulties that people had to overcome. And once they did overcome some of the immediate difficulties, it was then the psychological trauma that they still kept within themselves and made it more vulnerable for them to develop into hysteria as well.
How do the outbreaks start? So they begin with one person usually.
Yeah, so usually that one person is somebody who is seen as perhaps the leader of the group. Or that person is somebody who's already a little bit more vulnerable. And then it spreads to maybe the second or third person who may also have increased vulnerability compared to the rest of the group. And then, you know, it just goes on with no control. Of course, during that period, there'll be, you know, expression of things that maybe imagined, maybe illusioned. So, for example, misinterpretation of the stimuli, of real stimuli that's available, it may be misinterpreted, and then that can be spread to others as well because in a dissociative state, things can appear very different as well.
Why is that dissociative state shared? I think that is the thing that I can't. So, for example, if let's say I'm looking at a computer, yeah. but what I see is a mirror with someone else's face looking back at me, for example, yeah. Why is my dissociation shared by the next person who looks at this computer screen? You know, why is it the same sort of image or the same sort of trouble?
You know, we all share certain emotions. If we go for, let's say, a concert and it's our favorite band and you know the group in front is shouting and jeering and clapping and dancing, we might end up being doing that as well. It becomes contagious to some extent. So emotions do get shared depending on the environment, depending on the situation. And so similarly, even in hysteria, it can be shared as well. There is, though, in the study that was reported in 1971, there was a demarcation between different groups, though. So although they were largely students and teenagers and Malay, some teachers also did spread to some of the teachers as well. But it seemed to spare some of the other genders, the boys, in co-ed schools, and it seemed to spare the other ethnic groups as well. So there are some inherent things or in the demographics that actually predict hysteria as well.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist, and we're talking about mass hysteria, which has been known to affect us here in Malaysia as well. Up next, we try to find out exactly what's going on in the body or the brain when the condition strikes. And if you have got any questions at all about hysteria, mass or otherwise, give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. This is Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me today, Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist, and we're talking about mass hysteria. If you have got any questions, our phone lines are open. That number to call is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Now, we've been you've been using the word dissociative and, you know, talking about that sort of infectiveness, I guess, of emotions and thoughts. Yep. But what's exactly going on in the body or the brain when the condition strikes? I mean, the idea that it's contagious means, is it as simple as looking at somebody kind of falling apart next to you and then suddenly falling apart yourself? I mean, what happens?
Yeah, well, I think the key word here is conversion. So people are converting their stress, their the emotional turmoil into something else, into behavior and also somatoform symptoms. Some may develop a seizure-like attack or roll on the ground or scream and yell or start to have hallucinations, see things that are not there. Some may also start to harm themselves or maybe hit themselves as well. So all these symptoms are basically a conversion of their emotional and psychological symptoms into something that's behavioral and physical. Now, if one person does it because of an emotional problem, the people who share that emotional problem will start to, you know, start to feel the same sort of emotion as well. And they'll be reminded of that emotion and they find that that person's dealing with it through this conversion and they start to spread through that way. So, of course, they have to share the same thing. That's why gender and ethnicity is often one of the factors that is shared among people who are in this mass hysteria. So, for example, mass hysteria has been seen in Singapore in Chinese schools. It's been seen in Hong Kong and among Chinese people as well. It's even been seen in India. So as long as they share some demographics, then the risk increases if they're under combined stress.
Should we be taking mass hysteria as a sign that we're pushing our schoolgirls too hard or our school children too hard if you see it so often in schools?
I think what it is telling us is that we're not teaching them life skills. We're not teaching them how to deal with stress and manage stress as well. A lot of children in boarding schools sometimes are not there for, you know, because of their choice. And they need to deal with the stress that's accompanying that, you know, that position that they're in, being in a boarding school or being isolated from family or being isolated or away from their siblings and, you know, their normal friends. And if they don't have an opportunity to deal with it or talk to someone about it, then it gets expressed in a different way. A psychological way may not be acceptable in communities where we haven't actually matured psychologically. So physical and behavioral ways may be sometimes more acceptable, because then the community says, well, this is possession, this is some bad, you know, act that they did, or they, you know, stood on some spirits, or, you know, hurt some spirits. And so, you know, but talking about feeling depressed and anxious may actually bring on more labeling and stigma and shame than actually doing, you know, some behavioral activity.
There is a Malay term, lemah semangat, that is often associated with hysteria. Mm. How much power do our minds have over our physical and emotional health?
I think it plays a huge role. I mean, we now know studies showing that stress actually increases our risk for high cholesterol, for diabetes, for hypertension, for heart disease. And so the body and mind are one. And if emotionally we are not in a right frame of mind, it has a huge impact on us physically as well. I think the important thing is that we need to know how to, you know, manage our emotions and feelings. Mental hygiene would be essential in schools for people to learn and to be able to prevent from, you know, episodes of hysteria or, you know, trying to express in an inappropriate way.
If you've got any questions about mass hysteria, or you'd just like to pick Dr. Phillips' mind about anything that might be bothering yours, give us a call. That number is 03-7710-9000. You can also text 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. What is the treatment for mass hysteria? So when you have 40 or 50 people kind of, you know, just having a lot of difficulty all at once, what do you do in that situation?
Well, I think the first thing is that it'd be useful to find out how it started and who was the initial case.
Patient zero, so to speak.
Patient zero, yeah. Yeah, so we want to separate the first few patients, at least, the first few who started maybe developing the symptoms. And usually when they're separated and taken away, then the whole group actually calms down. Now, these few people in the beginning, in the first few cases, would usually require a little bit more psychological support. So they would benefit from seeing a psychologist or, if necessary, even a psychiatrist as well. And then the group needs to learn how to deal with stress and manage stress as well. It then needs to be looked at, you know, maybe closing down for a short while so that the background issues or stress is not going to affect the whole group continuously, and resolve some of those things that have been happening in the recent past. And then maybe, you know, having a discussion with the administrators and people in charge to see, you know, what's actually been incorporated or introduced recently that might have been a trigger as well.
I understand that there's also an anti-hysteria kit.
I've heard of it.
What are your thoughts on it?
What I heard is it didn't get used during this period of epidemic hysteria. I don't think it is medically, it's not a medical kit. And I think it's more working on the psychosocial aspects of hysteria, which is an important aspect as well. So, you know, the religious healers, the prayers, and, you know, maybe even the traditional healer, all of them play a role. But it'd be best to work together with, you know, mainstream psychiatrists and psychologists. And it doesn't matter which therapy works, but as long as, you know, the hysteria ends and people's psychological needs are met.
We have a question here from Amrin. Good afternoon, Amrin.
Good afternoon.
Hi, your question?
Okay, I have a few observations. I've come across these hysterical situations at few schools. One of them, how do you explain when we talk to the people, yes, who had been hysterical, mm-hmm, and they were both male and female students who experienced this hysteria? Mm-hmm. Now, when we interviewed them separately, mm-hmm. most of them saw the same images, even though they did not know what the others saw.
Yeah.
Now, how do you explain that? And then second, and I don't have the, I don't think I have the right to say that, no, you don't see those, because that's what they said, mm-hmm. they see. And I believe in them. There is no reason for me to say that they are wrong, because that's what they saw. Now, yeah. secondly, yes, stress does play a role in the vulnerability of the people who experience hysteria, but I think that's not the main reason why people see things that we think they do not see. And I think it's a bit unfair for us to say that, no, you don't actually see those things, because that's what they see. Just because we do not see those things do not mean that they do not see those things too.
Yeah.
So I think those two are the kind of issues that I would like you, if you could explain that.
Sure.
Thanks, Amrin.
Okay,
yeah. Well, Amrin's right. We don't challenge what they are experiencing because it's real. In their mind, it's real. But it's not arising from the right sort of perceptions or sensations. And it's actually coming from emotions. It's just like in some conversion disorders, people develop a paralysis. They have a paralysis of their leg or their hand. It doesn't fit in with what you'd expect with stroke or, you know, with real paralysis. But they're convinced that their limb is paralyzed. Now, that's an exhibition of an emotional stress that comes out as a physical problem. So we don't challenge them. We don't tell them, no, your leg is not paralyzed, you're lying, or, you know, come on, you can walk. We express that this may not be a physical factor that's causing the paralysis, but an emotional one. And so we need to start to uncover maybe their emotional health and look for symptoms and other things that may identify why they got vulnerable at this time. To develop these hallucinations or, you know, illusions that we may term as.
And as for Amrin's first question, we answered that a little earlier, but just as a refresher, why do people see the same things?
Yeah, well, suggestibility. It's mass hysteria, it's just like when, you know, you're in a certain sort of environment and everyone is having the same emotion. So similarly, in mass hysteria, when people do experience something, they may scream and yell about what they've actually experienced. And that same experience can then be, sort of through suggestibility, be experienced by another person as well.
If you've got any questions for Dr. Philip, give us a call. That number is 03-77-109-000. We're talking about mass hysteria, but you can also talk about anything that might be weighing on your mind. You can also text us at 016-201-9000 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Does this have a long-term effect? I mean, if I were a 15 or 17-year-old student who once, you know, in a state of severe SPM-induced stress, you know, I was part of a mass hysteric outbreak. Yeah. Could this have long-term repercussions on my mental health as I grow into an adult?
Yes, it can. People who have had acute stress episodes, be it psychological or through conversion into symptoms as dissociation and somatoform, can also have higher risk of developing depression and anxiety at a later age. And so it's important for us to actually look at interventions that are going to also protect them in their mental health for the future as well.
How much is actually known about the condition? Are there gaps in the research as it stands?
There's a huge amount of gap. I mean, I think one is that we tend to think of it as very separate from all other hysterical episodes in other countries, in other regions, and we think we're unique and, you know, this is only specific to Malaysia and, you know. But there have been similar sort of themes in hysterical episodes in the past in other countries and other parts of the world. Of course, some have changed to, you know, other sort of symptoms. There've been hyperventilation symptoms. There've been fears of terrorism or fears of of being possessed. So they change according to different groups, ethnicity and, you know, backgrounds. But they're generally the same in terms of the underlying mechanism.
How much does cultural pressure affect things? I mean, yes, we have mass hysteria here. We have mass hysteria cases around the world. But does it differ in terms of presentation or in terms of diagnosis when it comes to cultural differences or pressures?
Actually, scientifically, it doesn't differ. It's basically the same as what I mentioned earlier, dissociative disorder or somatoform disorder. The differences are really in its presentation. So it does spread similar to other countries and other regions, but the presentation may be very different from one place to another.
And I think when you're faced with something that you don't understand, Amrin's point earlier, I feel, was a lot to do with respect, giving due respect to people who are facing mass hysteria. And the problem is once these cases get reported, that's not always given, I think. And the responses to the reported mass hysteria at SMK Pangkalan Cipadua are polarized. Some are making fun of it. Some are dismissive. Others are concerned. How should we react to cases like this when we hear of mass hysteria happening? What would you suggest as a means for us to process what's going on?
Yeah, well, it is a real disorder. It is the, we would call it as an illness, and it is something that needs intervention. It's similar to any other illness. People who may have dengue and you've got epidemics of dengue and you have appropriate therapies and treatment for that. But similarly with hysteria, it can occur from time to time and it can have a huge impact on the people who are affected by it. And it can be treated and people can actually recover. So I think the important thing is to not sort of look at it as a weakness. It is an illness and it is something that can be treated and people can recover from as well.
Are there people on the other side of the divide? I mean, you say it is a real medical condition, but that some people have disagreed with. What are the arguments that are made by the skeptics?
Yeah, well, I think this is the challenge that we have in psychiatry and psychology. Because there's a huge interface and because symptoms sometimes resemble things related to, culture and background, that a lot of people think of it as not actually an illness. But the important thing is that, all therapies are beneficial. And so if we use something cultural, something that's, that is helpful in terms of, the patient's background, but we also use something that we know is medical and has had tests over time and, has been shown to be evidence-based, I think people benefit. Yeah? There are some regions where culture and background don't play much of a role anymore. And so then mainstream is the only thing that they resort to. But in countries like Malaysia and in countries that are still developing, culture and background play a huge role. And so they should be just as important as psychological therapies and interventions as well.
To close off, how do we cope with a condition that up till now is still not completely well understood?
Well, I think it's important to work together. Partnerships in trying to help and deal, looking at prevention rather than just intervention. And we know now what the risk groups are. There have been enough studies to show that it is particular to a certain subgroup and that we can actually put things in place to help prevent this from happening in future as well.
Thank you very much for coming in today, Dr. Philip. I've been speaking with Dr. Philip George, consultant psychiatrist. We've been discussing mass hysteria today. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.